Teach me your ways, O Lord, and I will walk in your truth. Give me an undivided heart that I may fear your name.
Interface. Not the same questions, not the same answers.
Hello, I'm Brad Johnson, and welcome to Interface, an examination of Christian perspectives on thought, faith, and culture with Adam Ayers, the pastor of Disciples Church in Costa Mesa, California, and the founder of the Stoa Foundation. Also joining us in Dancing Guppy Studios today are Tom Dunn and Chris Holowaty, and today our topic is dating.
The topic came up because Tom and I were discussing this a few days ago, and we're just talking about how seldom you hear people who are single talk about in an intelligent way or in a way that's really honest about dating. It's one of those topics that as a youth pastor I dealt with all the time with the kids. I mean, it's like more of the issue of how far can I go and more of issues dealing with sex and that kind of a thing. But I found it more curious to talk about how is a Christian single person to deal with the whole issue of dating. I mean, it happens. It's pretty common. We used to joke about our college career group at our church as being called, you know, spares and pairs. And it's this whole aspect of life that is obviously very common. I think most people take it for granted that, yeah, people date, no big deal. There are a number of competing views of Christian dating. And how do I put this without saying it snidely? But we have the whole passion and purity movement.
Set against the lack of self-control movement.
I guess, yeah, that's not the more well-defined, although possibly more commonly practiced method of dating. But there are all these issues of intimacy, issues of respect for one another. And I'd be curious to look into the scriptures as what does the Bible say, or does it say anything about dating at all? I'm not really interested in the whole why wait, high school, you know, that whole aspect of things. It's more of what does a single person do with their singleness and how do they interact with other single people? And what is the role of dating to be in the church or for Christians?
As far as scripture goes, though, the relationships took place in a much different way than our relationships do here in the United States in the year 2000. So,
but you have a lot of passages that are quoted extensively, such as in 1 Corinthians, all of Paul's discussions about it's not good for a man to touch a woman. He also talks about how it's better just to be single. So there's all kinds of questions we can raise up there, but I just kind of want to throw that out as an opening platform. And Tom, why don't you take it from there?
For those of you that aren't familiar with the Passion and Purity movement that Chris mentioned, came about from that book called Passion and Purity by Elizabeth Elliot, that in essence states, correct me if I'm wrong, since God has probably already chosen your mate for you, why look? Why date? If God's already chosen your mate and will probably present him or her to you, a la Isaac and Abraham's servant bringing Rebekah to Isaac, God in the same way will present your mate to you, your perfect mate to you.
Then she'll eat of the fruit and you'll both be damned forever.
There you go. So why even bother to date? In fact, the whole idea that you shouldn't even be looking, because in a sense that is a kind of wasting of your time, wasting of your energies, having a roving eye, whatever. The idea that God already has a mate for you, so why even look?
Tom, I think I detect a little bit of tension in your depiction there. What's your take on the whole passion, purity, dating thing?
In all honesty, Adam, I think it's an extreme position. The problem is, when we say, well, this is how God did it in the past with Isaac, and so this is probably how God will do it with you. Wait a minute. That's saying that you know how God will operate in most circumstances, and you know the mind of God? I mean, it just seems like a problem there. You know, I just feel like we're a huge amount of people, and so God has a huge amount of dealing with all of us. I think that we have to be careful in saying that this is how God does things when it comes to gray areas and things that aren't clearly delineated in the scriptures or in the traditions of the church. arranged marriages have existed for a long time and will continue to exist. Is that the right way? People have gone out searching for a mate, and they will probably continue to do that for a long time. So is that the way we should go? I mean, you can make an argument for both. You know, the man that has gone out to seek his fortune in the world, guided by God, or the one that has allowed his parents to designate which mate he's going to take. Both have been around for a very long time. So, I don't know, I don't think you can say that one is more godly than another.
Part of the thing about dating is that it's one of those topics that, well, people just kind of date and it just happens. And there's some obvious dangers to dating. And so maybe we can just start from there. And what I'd like to do is see if we can get to a spot where we can somewhat get close to maybe a proper idea of what dating could be or what it should be. There are some aspects about dating that I think are taken for granted that are unhealthy.
For example?
The whole issue of inappropriate intimacy. The issue of seeking to fulfill a person's loneliness by using someone else as a means to fulfill that loneliness. And we're not talking just sexual gratification, we're talking emotional gratification. I feel lonely, so I'll call up a girl and go out with her just so I don't feel so bad about myself.
Which can also be inappropriate intimacy. Inappropriate intimacy is not merely sexual.
Exactly. There's the whole question of what is a proper relationship to look like between a man and a woman who are both single. And I don't think this comes up in scripture quite as clearly as maybe some from different camps would say. I don't know. I haven't read Passion and Purity in at least 13 years, so I don't really remember what the view was in there. Other than that, she felt guilty about stroking Jim Elliot's cheek, facial cheek, which is a whole other topic. But I do feel like we are in somewhat of a gray area in this whole topic. But I think there are some principles that we can start to lay out for people who, particularly who are in their 20s or in their 30s, who are single.
Yeah, and I'd love to hear a definition of inappropriate intimacy. What, touching fingers, holding hands, kissing, using the tongue, heavy petting? If someone can find me a definition other than it's not good for a man to touch a woman, please let me hear it from Scripture. I think it's problematic because it is so gray and undefined and seemingly vague in a lot of ways. And left up to conscience, which is a whole nother gray area, it seems, at times. You know, what's sin for one is not sin for another. Or that which is not of faith is sin. You know, if you think something is sin, chances are it probably is sin. But is it sin for somebody else?
I think that we can't afford to forget that, particularly in our culture, there is a lack of a unified social narrative, a lack of a coherent or cohesive social mode, but that persons growing up in American culture, particularly through the influence of the media in all of their varied forms, a high degree of literacy, a high degree of cultural interchange, and really a variegated sociocultural landscape. People growing up in this sort of an environment do not have a clear social taboo system that persons in, say, a tribal society in ancient Palestine or in developing patriarchal era had. If one lives in a semi-nomadic tribe traveling through ancient Palestine, there's a very clear set of the way we do things. We travel across, all the way across Fertile Crescent, find a cousin. Now you got to make sure you go all the way across the Fertile Crescent, all the way back to Mesopotamia to make sure that you marry your cousin. Okay, if we're going to talk about biblical forms of dating, and if we're going to use the God will provide you a mate paradigm, then we're probably also going to have to embrace marrying our cousins and making sure that it all stays in the family, which is very much what they did back then. That it is somehow sinful unless you marry someone who is a blood relative. Okay, that's a little bit taboo now to modern Western evangelicalism. I don't think it would go over very well if I attempted to date my cousin, you see. It would also be the biblical paradigm that you sleep with them first, and that's what makes them your spouse. So you take a stranger, you take them into your mother's tent, you sleep with them, then that's obviously binding the contract, and now you're married, if that's the way God provides you with a spouse. So if we're going to talk about precedent from the patriarchal narratives, we're going to get ourselves in deep trouble very quickly. I think what we can't fail to recognize is that there are many voices and many sociocultural patterns involved in the idea of courtship and marriage. We cannot forget that marriage is a social contract and that dating, at least in Western America, tends to be related to marriage. That is a gender-oriented activity that's somehow focused to committed relationship. And as Christians, we think of that as marriage. Even if we think about that strange period of Western dating, that is engagement. What is engagement? It is that we have made a promise to make sure that we make a promise. And so there's this undefined, neither married nor not married period of engagement that has come about really as a social norm. It's not that you go from not being committed to being married as they did in ancient patriarchal times. Oh, hi, nice to meet you. Let's go sleep together and you're my wife. No engagement, no anything, no dating, just a commitment, a pure commitment. Hi, I'd like you to meet your wife. We picked her out for you at a bazaar, sort of a thing, to this idea of a process and certain stages in process that we have in Western American culture that have been socially determined as attendant phenomena to marriage commitment. We now have to really synthesize theology and Christian practice to fit our social institutions. And so what we're really trying to do is say, how do we synthesize Christian behavior into a socially determined model? And that in this process, now we must recognize there are many socially determined models. So how would an Aleut Indian Christian synthesize Christianity into their marriage model? How would an Indian Christian synthesize Christian theology into an arranged marriage model? How would an Iranian or a Persian Christian synthesize theology into their marriage model? And varieties between the Midwest, the West, the East, high society, low society, poverty-stricken society, those kinds of things. So we really have to say, what is the micro-milieu, and how do we synthesize Christian theology into that micro-milieu down to family systems?
Some might say, well, just read the Bible, and it's all right there, and it'll tell you how to do good Christian marriages.
Yes, if I'm a semi-nomadic ancient Palestinian, or if I'm a Roman-era Hellenized Jewish Palestinian, then perhaps. I mean, I can always read Tobit and get a good handle on how dating is supposed to take place or something like that. But we have to say the terms in Scripture, when it says married, it's saying a social thing. Just like when it says war, it's saying a different thing. What is war in an ancient nomadic society? What is a king to Abraham? It's a different thing than what a king is by the time of, say, Isaiah. So a tribal leader being a king in the time of Abraham is not the same as a national king in the time of Isaiah. So we have to recognize that there are social institutions at play here, not just simply terminology. The terms don't stay the same. So what a marriage is in the time of the patriarchs, i.e. go and get your cousin, sleep with her, and add her to the clan so that you can have more babies with the family name and features, is different than what marriage is when Paul talks about a marriage of a believer with an unbeliever in a Hellenized world. So yes, the Bible does tell you, but the Bible tells you in socially specific manners. And that's talking about marriages, not about dating. So the process of courtship is different in different instances.
What does that word courtship mean? Because I know it's a relatively modern term.
I don't know about the etymology of the term, or in other words, the source of the term itself. I know that what it refers to is that process of social interaction through which a man and a woman negotiate their romantic commitments. The difficulty with trying to apply courtship ideas in our modern terms, like really from Victorian eras on, the idea that you go through this process of meeting, almost like what the rules, the book recently published, The Rules, that there are certain rules of etiquette that must be satisfied in the process of coming together. In our modern times, we have at least the satisfactions of they have to meet, they have to introduce, they have to agree to be exclusive, they have to then agree to go through the process of arranging a wedding, then they have to go arrange that wedding and follow through with the ceremony. Those are the minimum. But in ancient times, biblical times, it's really business negotiations. How many camels? What kind of dowry? What sort of family promises are made? For Solomon, it was the making of international treaties. by exchanging brides. That's typically how it works. They're almost really hostages more than anything else. They're interchange of tribal ties. So for us, we really have to say, do we exist in a society that has the kind of patriarchal structures that courtship can exist in? What are our ideals? And I think something we can't forget here is we're not really talking only about single teens, 20s, 30s. We're talking about divorcees. We're talking about widows, widowers. What is the appropriate dating style? When we're not just talking about a 22-year-old fresh out of college, we're also talking about for a 55-year-old recent grandmother who has lost her husband, how does she date and whom? Where does someone like that go about meeting a companion? And should that companion be simply focused on getting remarried? Or could there be a benign, simple courtship that is just, I wanted a masculine presence in my life. I don't want to be married. I don't want to start another family. But I want a masculine presence in my life. I've lived with a masculine presence forever, and I feel a lack of a masculine presence in my life. And I want someone to go do things with, attend social functions, attend my children's and my grandchildren's parties, and I want an escort. Is there something wrong with that? I don't think we can just lightly dismiss the idea of care, both physical and emotional, of presence, and of God's basic statement, it's not good for someone to be alone, and that aloneness is not only satisfied in marriage. Aloneness was not nearly the problem in an ancient tribal situation, but aloneness is a problem when we live in a metropolitan area that isolates the individual in the midst of 13 million and does not have clan structures, does not have family structures, and is geographically diverse and diffused, where there are certain social strata that are only accessible in couples. And is there somehow something wrong with, say, a 55-year-old widow having a male escort companion with whom there is physical caregiving, not in the sense of sexual intimacy, but in the sense perhaps kissing, perhaps holding hands, perhaps simply being held, and not being married, but simply someone to be with? Is that right or is that wrong? From a Christian perspective, to give love and to give care without crossing ordinary boundaries of sexuality.
You bring up an interesting point, Adam. If I may challenge something you said earlier, Chris, about, you know, that it's not necessarily good to date just because you feel alone. Says who? Why not? It's not good for the man to be alone. It would seem that God said it's a very viable reason to have a companion because you feel simply alone, or you are simply alone, especially in this isolated society, like you just said, Adam.
We were talking about inappropriate intimacy, and when I bring up the topic of trying to get someone to fulfill your loneliness, and we talk about companionship, there is an implied commitment there. What I'm talking about is if I'm feeling lonely tonight, I feel empty. I feel a lack, and I just want to date. I just want to go out with someone just to hang out with someone because I just personally feel empty. I think there is something inappropriate to use someone in order to fulfill what I perceive as lacking inside of myself. Now, I think there's a subtle distinction there, but when I was dating, I knew when I was dating someone simply because I didn't want to be alone. I didn't want to be by myself. Didn't want to maybe spend time with God. Didn't want to have to deal with whatever I was dealing with. I wanted to escape. And so I would use people to fill that up. And that's what I was referring to.
I hear you, Chris. And yet Adam had perfect unbroken fellowship with God. No real reason to need another. And yet God said it's not good for the man to be alone. Simply alone, not... Well, it'd be a good idea for the man to be able to give his love to somebody and commit to somebody. No, it's simply in his unbroken fellowship, in his perfection, in his being about his Father's business, it is not good for the man to be alone. Only reason, it's not good for the man to be alone, so I'm going to give him a person to be that, to fulfill that. I don't see any particularly grand, noble thing in that. I see a lack and God filling it. What's the difference?
Again, what I said was, I'm looking at a long-term commitment. When God provided someone for Adam, he didn't just provide someone for the evening that he could discard when he was done. When he decided that this was satiated within himself, that, okay, I've gotten to spend some time with somebody now. Great, thanks. I'm moving on. That's where I say the danger is with what I call inappropriate intimacy, where I'm wounding someone because I'm not entering into this as I'm going to help you in your loneliness as you help me in mine, and we're going to fulfill something within each other. It's I'm going to use you for now, and then I intend to discard you later.
I think what you bring up by noting these kinds of interactions is that there is a unique aspect of humanity. Human beings place meaning in actions, that actions of themselves do not have identities, but that those actions are given meaning. When we think about speech, we think about it's just vibrations in air. But somehow, those vibrations that we make in the air carry something about who we are. If you want to say they embody and incarnate our intention, our unseen selves, into the experienced self. And that our words, our symbols, our writings, our art, our sounds, our touches, our proximities, our facial expressions, all of these things somehow embody our unseen self. And really what we touch in on this is the language of proximity, the language of touch, the language of sound. What are we saying? Are we saying by a kiss, thank you very much for being in proximity to me and gratifying my need to be pleasure stimulated? Or are we saying, I value you, I cherish you, thanks for being a member of the family, I'm glad you're my cousin? What are we saying with this? That this is not simply touch, this is language. And that to get to the heart of dating, we have to say, what are we saying and what is the intention behind what we say? I think that's a discussion that's a little bit too much for an opener, but it's the kind of thing that we need to get to. If we're going to get to the heart of this matter, we need to get to the heart of our hearts. How are we trying to relate to other human beings as Christians, and what are the ways in which we're communicating that intention toward them or toward ourselves? And how is that intention brought under submission to God or not brought into submission to God? Because we can spend all day talking about whether the symbol of stroking Jim Elliot's cheek is appropriate for Elizabeth Elliot to do or not before she's married, but that is only the symbol. And what is far more necessary, especially according to Christ, would be, what is the heart behind this? Because it is not whether you actually commit adultery, it is the lust in your heart. Or it is not actually the murder, it is the anger in your heart. So what is the heart that we take into our social norms and mores? And how can we be Christians in the middle of those, in a social milieu that's determined for us, just like language is determined before we arrive? And I think that's maybe a topic for a subsequent show. What do you think, Bradley?
I think we have more than enough to talk about for at least one more show. So please join us the next time we get together to further discuss this topic. Thanks to Adam Ayers, Tom Dunn, and Chris Holowaty for being here. Thanks to Chris for engineering the show today. Thanks to Dancing Guppy Studios for helping to make Interface possible. And thanks to you for listening.